is...
Well, three is 50.
We continue with your act for Ms. Ayers.
All right, where did we leave off? The Community Housing Caucus. What is it about that document that you wanted to say?
Yeah, so as I was collecting information and trying to understand what was at risk in my urban village, I talked to two people who were a part of this caucus. One was John Grant, and another was one of the moms at my school who's a developer and sat in on the early committee meetings. And I had never heard of this white paper. It's called Seattle's Solutions to Seattle's Housing Emergency. And this has been submitted as an exhibit, but not under my name. So I don't know the number.
But I wrote it at the top.
Oh, okay.
It's Sun 12, Seniors United, or does Sun stand for? And it's on their list. Council has it. We'll deal with exhibits after Ms. Ayers is done.
So why are we doing the exhibits later? We've been
been going. I'll put in.
Because otherwise the record is not tracking the number for what.
Keep me in order. Sun 12, I would submit, and I'll get the PDF to Elena forthwith.
I see. So you're not introducing it now because you don't have a copy for the hearing examiner.
I have a marked up copy.
Okay.
I can have my copy.
It's underlined. You want underlined?
Oh, actually, you know what? Let me see if all the pages are there. It might not be.
Okay. Let's.
I don't think we should submit it.
All right. It's not helping. So let's go ahead with the testimony.
Okay. So why is that important to you?
So I had not read this before, and when I read it, I and then talking with John Grant and this woman from my school, I took to understand that this was a pretty unique process, and it was very multidisciplinary, seen as a best practice. Both people that talked about it were very proud to be a part of it. And so I looked through the solutions that they outlined for Seattle's housing emergency, and they have a whole section on preservation of existing subsidized housing. And so that was exactly what I was trying to investigate and understand for my urban village. And so I found it really helpful to read this paper, and they outline the importance of, if I was going to summarize it, what I took away is that the importance of inventorying what we currently have and understanding the specifics of who owns them, what is in each neighborhood, when are they expiring, and then having strategies developed to make sure that when those properties come up for sale, that the city has a first right of refusal, that they're dedicating resources toward helping nonprofit developers obtain those parcels or properties when they come up for sale, and other strategies outlined in terms of preserving the existing subsidized housing. And as a layperson reading this, I took note of this and thought, well, I'm not an expert, but all of these experts felt that this was an important thing that we should be doing. And that's part of why we took it upon ourselves to inventory the subsidized units in our neighborhood.
So did you find any of the baseline information in the EIS when you looked for it?
Not to my knowledge, no, I didn't. I didn't find... again, it wasn't the analysis that I found in the EIS is kind of categorized broadly into these kind of broad brushstroke categories of the four typologies, and nothing that I could find that kind of inventoried at a neighborhood or the urban village level existing affordable housing or the ownership or when it expires or anything like that.
Did you find anything concerning mitigation or impacts on your community in the EIS?
Not specifically for my community. And in fact, and I'm sorry, I don't have a printout with the exact page numbers. But overall, I was surprised at how high level the analysis and the mitigations were. And there was, to my understanding, there was no mention of the Madison Miller urban village and specific or even citywide mitigations that get at what I found in this white paper, which was let's inventory these units and let's make sure that we have strategies or policies in place to make sure that we don't lose them over time, sort of a no net loss strategy. And I don't think there was any, certainly nothing related to Madison Miller in the EIS that I could find.
Well, my last question is, do you have anything else you'd like to tell the hearing examiner about this process and what might happen to your community or to your own living situation? Well, before we get to that, let's look together at this, and you were able to find your part of Madison Miller on that Exhibit 69
yes.
map. You indicated as the highest up zone area.
We are. Well, what's the highest? Is it red or the purpley red?
The red,
yes.
Area. So do you think
like the upper quadrant.
Yeah. So do you think that kind of implies that the increase in property values and resulting displacement is going to move north of Madison?
Ask me
well,
that again.
You talked about Madison and John being kind of boundaries at the present. Is that boundary going to move north over you?
I think the boundary, you mean for like the price of property and
yes, and displacement.
I think it will move. The part of our urban village that lies to the south of me, all those property prices are going up. That's at least what I've observed.
Okay. Anything else?
Let me just look at my last notes here. I guess the only other piece that I wanted to point out was that the EIS talks about one of the mitigations that they've talked about and the data that they used in trying to understand displacement is the tenant relocation assistance ordinance, which I have limited understanding of. But when I read that, I was concerned because that is a city ordinance that requires developers to pay low-income tenants
relocation.
Okay, that is what it's called. Assistance, kind of stipend, and the EIS says that it does have flaws and that there's it's not a great baseline in terms of displacement. But I know that when we had a tenant in our house before the tenants upstairs, she was low income, and we decided to renovate the unit because it was very old. This is right, you know, it had never been remodeled after my husband bought the house. And so we looked into that program for her, and she would have never known that program was available to her. And I just question that as a reliable data point for tracking on displacement. And the only reason why I bring it up, because it was Of the anti-displacement, this is in the summary section of the housing and economics, and I'm sorry I don't have a page number, but under the anti-displacement for the preferred alternatives, there's only three bullets, and it's the first one, and I just found that of all the things the city could have outlined in terms of mitigations to stop the displacement, I was surprised that the tenant relocation assistance ordinance was one of them. And yeah, so I just was kind of disappointed by that. Boy, I could say a lot more, but I don't think I will. This has been
nothing
a long
further,
day, I know.
Unless,
yeah, may I have it? Am I allowed to ask questions of this witness?
I assume scale,
yes.
Cross-listed.
Right.
Yeah. So you're going direct, not,
yes.
Okay.
Right. So Dave Bricklin, lawyer for scale. Ms. Johnson, could you bring up those photos? We're not going to offer these, but I wanted to ask you if you could provide the examiner with a paint a picture with words, and then we're going to see if I can find some photos of your neighborhood so we know what we're talking about.
Well, my block, as I said, is all single-family homes, about two stories. One has a rooftop deck, so it's a little taller, but lots of trees.
Right.
And
let's see. So we brought up a picture here.
Yeah, so that you're looking at, that second van there used to be ours, so that you see the truck in the front there, and then there's a little minivan behind it. That's right in front of our house.
Right.
You can imagine that we collect a lot of baseballs and soccer balls in our front yard.
So that's the Miller Playfield.
Miller Playfield is across the street, and then Meany Middle School is right to the north of that. We can hear the bell from our house, and Meany just reopened this year for the first time as a regional middle school, and it's slated to have 1,000 students over the next, I think, 5 years. So,
in terms of the character of the Miller, Madison Miller neighborhood, as you move north from your house, how would you describe that? Let's go to the next.
Similar to what you see there. Trees almost down every street, lots of front yards, quite quiet, even though we're only a couple streets off 23rd and a couple streets off Madison. I know my dad, who lives in a very rural area, was commenting on how quiet and residential it felt. Lots of interactions with neighbors and lots of gardens and a couple pea patches.
Let's move to the next picture.
Relatively narrow streets.
Yeah. Right. And this one's indicated as being 20th.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm.
So now let's find these on the map, if you will. So I have before you Appendix H, and let's see what the proposed zoning changes are for this area.
Yeah.
So hold on a second until the examiner gets there. So this is Exhibit H47.
Not 47, 48.
Well, so I'm using the exhibit number, not the page number.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, they're one off from each
other. Oh, you're right. I see that now.
Yeah. It's very confusing.
Yes.
So H47 is the alternative two, and then we'll in a second turn to alternative three and the preferred alternative. But so first of all, can you you see the lime green area in the middle of that area? Urban Village, that lime green?
Light green.
Light green, I guess so.
Sort of an L-shaped,
yes.
Light green.
Is that the playfield area?
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Yeah, the top part of the L is a community park, and the horizontal part of the L is the regional playfield.
All right. And where you said you live across the street from the playfield, which part?
I do. I live right in the middle of that block between John and Thomas, so right in the middle of that horizontal part of the L, and I am in the zone that has the cross hatches.
Okay.
Which is, I believe, means that it has a larger increase in zoning change.
So that's going to be the what we've heard is an M1 or M2 designation, more than the standard up zone.
Yes.
Okay. And as you go around Miller Playfield, you know, kind of do a horseshoe around the northern part of it, looks like most of the rest of the area is just the standard up zone, mm-hmm. except when you get over opposite from your place, just if you cut right across the playfield.
Yep.
Again, there's some hatched area there.
Yep.
All right, now let's look at the next page, H48. And this was the alternative. This is alternative three. Again, you're just to the right of the horizontal part of the L.
Yep.
Still crosshatched. Now I see appears almost everything around the playfield for several blocks is in the double
yep.
or triple up zone area. Is
mm-hmm.
that right?
Mm-hmm.
And then let's go one more page to H49. This looks to be something of a compromise, somewhere in between the first two. But you're still in the hatched. Some of the areas to the west are hatched, and other areas have now gone or with the single up zone.
Yes. Right? Exhibit 49 is which preferred alternative? Oh,
the preferred alternative.
The preferred alternative.
Yeah.
Okay.
This was the one that did not appear in the draft EIS.
I see.
And appeared
yep.
in the final.
Yeah, so my block in particular is still hatched, but low rise one.
Right.
And then there's still the residential small lot to the north of me.
All right. And, for instance, this picture that's up there at Mercer and 20th, can you locate Mercer and 20th on this map?
Yeah, it's at the very top.
Mm-hmm.
See on the top where there's that funny little random bump out?
Yeah.
It's one street below that.
Okay.
So that's 20th that kind of bisects right down the middle of our urban village. And Mercer is, so Roy is the top street.
Yep.
And then Mercer is the next street down.
All right. So as we look north on 20th here on this image, the left-hand side appears, both sides are being upzoned, but the left-hand side being upzoned in the hatched area, meaning an M1 or M2
yep.
level upzone.
Mm-hmm.
All right. All right. Well, thank you. I just wanted to kind of bring some
sure. Thank you.
Some sense of what your neighborhood was like and
yeah.
related to that zoning. Thank you. That's all I have for this witness.
So, Mr. Thaler, where are we with the exhibits?
Well, I have them all here in front of me as PDFs, and I have marked up as just two. It's the scale 133, the table, and the Sun 12, which is the Community Housing Caucus document. And I can email them after.
Well, tomorrow morning we'll bring
I'll
paper
bring
copies.
In paper copies.
And there are two. There's a table and the white
There's
paper.
There's a one-page table, the inventory of subsidized affordable housing and non-subsidized affordable housing in Madison Miller that she discussed, and then the community housing document. That's a one-pager, and the other is less than a dozen.
The white paper?
Yes.
All right. I've also asked that if witnesses are relying on notes that we would introduce those into.
I can do that.
And are you doing that now or then as well?
I can do that right now.
Okay. The notes will be Exhibit 121. And we'll do a placeholder for 122 and 123, just for consistency in the record for the other two. With 122 being the table, and 123 being the white paper.
Okay. So why did these come back to me?
By mistake. I thought...
No, it's a five-page.
Oh, yeah, they're not stapled. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I gave her the first... I thought those were copies. By mistake.
And with that, we'll go on to cross, unless
just
questions.
A clarifying question about the notes issue, because I think this
yes.
started to come about based on a hearsay objection that I made
mm-hmm.
way back when. So is your consideration in any way limited? In other words, if a witness testifies, obviously their testimony you're considering as evidence. Are you considering what's in their notes as evidence, or are you putting these in the record just to
If they're in the record, then they're evidence. Okay. If they're given an exhibit, then they're in there in the record.
So in the future, could we ask...
The challenge is, if they're relying on the notes, then everyone needs to see them.
Right.
And so they become an exhibit at that point.
It's difficult to, if they're, again, if they're testifying from the notes, relying on them, that's kind of one thing. If the notes are far more expansive than their testimony, then it's difficult to question them about that evidence. So I was wondering if in the future, if parties are going to do this, could we ask that they provide in advance, the notes in advance, so we would at least have them to prepare,
so,
help prepare our...
Ideally, what we would have is if there are any witnesses, this would be helpful for you to hear too, Mr. Thaler.
Yes, I agree.
If there are any witnesses that are coming before us that are going to rely on notes, that the other parties get copies of that, because it's either the other parties or I'm going to notice they're using notes, and that's going to need to come into evidence.
Okay.
I'd also like to ask that if we are going, that we could limit the illustrative exhibits that have been coming in. If someone's got a book, you don't have to introduce it, but the photos, the websites, we was pretty expansive today. And if it's not an exhibit that's coming in, I really don't want to see too much. The it's been a very broad definition of illustrative exhibits. And lastly, if you're going to use an exhibit and reference it within a witness, make sure you have copies here so that it actually gets introduced on that same day.
Yes, I agree. I admit I erred in that, working too late. And concerning the notes, I agree with Mr. Johnson that I didn't get to all the questions in here, and there's material in here that isn't not subject to his cross. So I'm agreeing with counsel for the city on that concern about the notes, and I also wonder, notes can be pretty sketchy, so we're put to the dilemma of how I'm instructing witnesses not to read it as if it's a speech, like Mr. Bloom clearly did. So we produced his speech, and Ms. Ayers clearly does not need the notes as a speech. So it doesn't. I'm on the verge of asking that her notes be withdrawn, because everything that makes sense for her as that presenting to you as evidence, she's already said it, and the notes don't add to it. They go beyond in a way that I think is inappropriate.
Well, so the challenge I have is your witness is relying on these notes. It's looking at you have witnesses. This is not the first one. We've had other witnesses doing the same thing, looking at notes. And opposing counsel has a right to look at those. I want to know what they're looking at. So once you open that box with having, I mean, you control the witness, and you had them have notes. I don't know what's stapled in there. I don't know what's in those. But I'm not going to exclude notes that were definitely relied on by a witness. Okay. If you can draw a line through those notes and find out what is admissible based on the testimony that was put in, that would be very helpful. If there are sections that were not referenced, we could deduct sections out, or don't have witnesses that use notes. I don't know how else to do it.
The main part of the notes that I was referring to were the part about the numbers, because I didn't want to get those incorrect. So
yeah.
Apologies, I didn't realize that.
That's nothing wrong with it.
That's
nothing wrong with it at all.
There's
nothing wrong with it. It's just if this is the process, if
okay.
You use notes.
That's fair. I suggest that numbers 12, 13, and 14 be redacted.
Do I have a copy yet? 121.
hopefully so, your copy reflects the same thing, which is they are about the RSJ.
Which numbers?
13 and 14. Did you read the city's race and social justice review?
13 and 14?
Yes. Assuming that they're what I just said.
Yes.
Then did not go there. So those two can be redacted.
Any other concerns from the city that there's
well, we haven't had a chance to review this word for word.
No, I didn't mean it. Sort of 30-minute call me about this, but
well,
it's just that it's my concern arises from kind of supplementation of testimonial evidence with notes that we have either seen, you know, just at the same time the witness is testifying. It's very difficult to prepare any cross-examination of that. That's why I asked the question. You know, obviously, in trial court practice, we would generally not have the notes exhibit unless admitted as an exhibit unless they were subject to an objection that was, you know, going to be in the appellate record or something, but not necessarily for the finder of fact to be relying on as evidence themselves in lieu of or in supplementation to the testifying witness. So that was the basis for my question.
So if they come in as exhibit here, we don't have a way of differentiating that unless somebody marks it in the record. And no one's done that so far. If there's an objection to an exhibit coming in and someone wants to list that objection and let me know that it should only come in for a limited purpose, that's on the party who has that objection to raise it.
I guess maybe the way to split the baby here going forward would be to require a party who's going to have their witness use notes provide them, you know, 12 hours in advance or something. So at least then we know what that testimony consists of and we're better prepared to do a complete cross-examination of the witness while they're here.
Does that work for appellants?
Work.
You guys have all the witnesses to organize, so
yeah, this is some coming.
Some are, you know, I mean, obviously what we're often talking about are expert witnesses who have bullet points based on a report that's going to be in the record, and so it's not a big deal. But if we have pro se witnesses coming in to speak their piece about their community, it becomes a little more problematic and challenging for the appellants to do that in advance.
I can live with that.
All right, we'll give it a shot.
Yeah, we'll
if it comes up,
we'll
then we'll address that when it comes
you.
Up. For now, Exhibit 121. Oh.